Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're going to step off from looking at particular chunky issues in ethics and life and culture and society and technology to do one of our kind of step back episodes, looking at something a bit more theological, but obviously plays into what we think about on this podcast quite a lot. And that is that famous Psalm 139. Let me begin by reading the particularly relevant section, which people will be familiar with. But Psalm 139 from verse 13. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I am awake, I am still with you. Why are we talking about this psalm today, Dad?
Yeah, it is an astonishing psalm. And in my own spiritual journey, you know, this psalm has haunted me from the time I first came alive as a Christian, as a student. You know, and 50 years later, it's still one of the most significant psalms, and I very often use it as a form of meditation and reflection. It's such a rich, inexhaustible theme.
Mm. And it's clearly a psalm that I think Christians have constantly come back to and try to pull out fresh meaning from, and new implications, and even entire kind of systems of social ethics plays into questions, a lot of questions around abortion and the status of the unborn child. So it's clearly a kind of very relevant psalm. I think what people try to assume it is a relevant psalm, and we'll discuss about how appropriate some of that ethicizing is. But it's clearly also something that has been significant, I think, all the way back to the church fathers were kind of writing about this long before our current agonies around kind of abortion or reproductive technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and of course, abortion is a very ancient issue, as is miscarriage. I mean, you know, the ancient world were well aware of both, you know, of abortion, of miscarriage, and also of infanticide. You know, these were very well recognized, culturally accepted practices in many parts of the ancient world, and so, you know, it's inevitable that Christian thinkers and theologians and practitioners have always had to wrestle with these issues, and we're simply 2,000 years later, you know, going around the same loops in some way. We have new twists, of course, and you know, in my professional work, I spent a great deal of time engaging with the science about embryonic and fetal development, about how it goes wrong, you know, how different parts of the fetus develop, about fetal medicine, intervening with the unborn baby. And actually, just this reminds me that one of the things to flag up, which is so interesting about this part of existence, is that there is no neutral language. I don't know if you already noticed that, but you know, do we talk about the fetus or do we talk about an unborn baby? Because as soon as you take one of those words or phrases, you've immediately betrayed a whole kind of assumptions and moral commitments. So when we talk about the fetus, that's a deliberately scientific, biological, impersonal term, which is a kind of distancing term. When you talk about an unborn baby, you're immediately taking a kind of commitment. This is a baby. This is a significant. This is a being like us.
Mm. Yes. And I'm sure we'll effortlessly slip between those two languages throughout the podcast.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I often, when I'm talking in a secular area about this, in a secular context, I very frequently flag that up right at the beginning, and then I deliberately switch from one to the other, you know, when I'm in a secular context. So in a sense, people can't work out. I'm not immediately prejudging how we should think about this being.
I even once came across a book which was written by, I think it was by a Christian, but was trying to kind of open up people's eyes. And so not again. And so the author decided, when talking about the question of the unborn child or the fetus, to come up with a completely new term, which didn't have any, I think they went for new one or something like that. So it didn't have any kind of loaded assumptions, didn't nail your colours. And you could talk about it kind of in a more dispassionate sense rather than getting sucked into either side.
That's absolutely right. And people have tried to come up with some kind of a phrase that is completely different. But yeah, so it just, I mean, what it flags up is that this is contested territory. You know, it always has been contested territory. If you think that we can talk about this in some kind of abstract neutrality, it's simply impossible.
Yeah.
And clearly, Psalm 139 is a very central part of framing how Christians have thought about the unborn.
Before we get there, though, should we just briefly discuss what the psalm is saying on the face of it? So it's said, it's described as a psalm of David. Do we know what was going on in David's life, whereabouts in his journey, his story? Do we have any idea about what was going on when he wrote this particular psalm?
No, we don't. And I think that it is important. I have reflected on this that, you know, because actually it's very striking. So many of David's psalms are really quite violent and quite, they express very forceful. And in fact, even in this psalm, don't we? We've got this little bit from verse 19 to verse 22. We've had this sort of deep thoughtfulness about, you know, and emotionally says, and then it suddenly says, if only you would slay the wicked, O God, away from me, you bloodthirsty man. They speak of you with evil intent and so on. Do I not hate those who hate you? So this is like, you know, as I've talked about this psalm, sometimes I've tried, you know, what do I do with those verses? You know, do I just airbrush them out? Do I try and incorporate them? But I think that David is basically a warrior. He's lived his life so many times on the battlefield. You know, he's killed people. He's watched people being slaughtered and hacked apart. You know, he's sent people to their death. He's planned military massacres.
And his throne is constantly under threat, including from his own family. You know, coups being launched against him. He's you know, we think of him as a king in Jerusalem, but effectively he's a kind of warlord who's risen to prominence over what was a kind of small, fractious tribal entity. And that's
right.
Threat from kind of rivals who would grab power.
Yeah, it's true. And he, therefore, we shouldn't be surprised that these themes of violence and warfare and judgment and retribution, you know, recur very commonly in the Psalms. But what is so extraordinary about this one is that, you know, that David is also capable of this exquisitely sensitive, reflective, and emotionally profound, intelligent reflection. So that, you know, he's a remarkable man, and he's done some evil things. He's a deeply flawed and fallen person. And of course, it's interesting, isn't it, that God eventually says, you know, David, you can't build my temple because you've got too much blood on your hands, is the implication.
Yes. And yet, despite that, this figure kind of inaugurates this kind of royal Davidic kingly line, which becomes a kind of central theme of all those messianic prophecies later on in the history of Israel, and is fulfilled in the person of Jesus, who is the son of David. As I was always taught when I was younger, Dad, a text without a context is little more than a con. And so,
is that what you were taught, Sam?
A bit. So we should always try and think about, rather than just snipping out the verses that we like. So I start, the bit I read earlier is actually verses 13 to 18, but the first 12 verses, the first half of the psalm, it's not really about the unborn child or the fetus. The theme is clearly about the kind of closeness and intimacy of God. You know, you search me, you know when I sit, when I rise, before a word is on my tongue, you hem me in behind me. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee? Surely the darkness will hide me and the light becomes night to me. Even the darkness will not be dark to you, and the night will shine like day, for darkness is light to you. So it's a kind of meditation, a prayer almost, about God's closeness to David and the kind of intimate knowledge of David that God has, that there's no way to hide. And then he develops that thought into, look, even when I was in the darkest place, before I was born inside my mother's womb, you knew me, you created me, nothing was hidden from you.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And in fact, I think there's a real sense of claustrophobia here. I mean, if you go back to verse 5, you know, he's reflected about, you know, the all-encompassing knowledge of God. You know, you are familiar with all my ways. You know, there's nothing you don't know about me. Mm. And then this astonishing thing, before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You know, so occasionally, aren't these little verses drop in, you know, like the very hairs of your head are numbered, you know, or the cattle on the thousand hill, you know, whatever it is, these little phrases drop in. And if you actually took that seriously, it is utterly mind-boggling, you know, the degree of the intimacy of God's knowledge of each one of us. And I think there's this claustrophobia, you hem me in behind and before, you have laid your hand on me, such knowledge is too wonderful for me, where can I go from your spirit? So it's almost like, you know, get off my back, God, you know, you're too close, I need a bit of space here. And so then he goes on this thought experiment, you know, is there anywhere I can go on the planet to get a bit of space from this claustrophobic God who's on my back? Yeah. And you know, everywhere I go, even I go in the depths of the earth, lo and behold, you know, the darkness is light to you. So then he says, well, can I go back in my personal history? And can I find any point in the past where at least I was free from this all-invading God? And I think wonderfully and terrifyingly, he says, however far I go back, even to my very beginnings, you were there. Mm. You enfolded me. You knew me. There is no escape. There is absolutely no escape.
And we have to remember, this is written at a time when people had absolutely no idea what was going on inside women's wombs. They knew that men and women had sex and then a baby started growing sometimes, and 9 months later the baby came out. But they had no idea, no ability to look within and sense how do children grow? How does that happen?
Yeah, not quite true, because, of course, they saw miscarriages. They saw terrible disasters when, you know, pregnant women were hacked apart, you know. So it's not that they were completely unaware, but what they saw was quite mysterious. And you know, what was this thing? Again, we've got to be sensitive here. We're talking about people may well have experienced miscarriages or even abortion and so on. So again, we just need to flag up. We're well aware of the fact that we're two blokes talking about things which can be deeply emotionally sensitive, but nonetheless, there was a limited understanding, but it was all deeply mysterious. It was all going on in a way that you could never see, and that's one of the astonishing things to me about modern ultrasound, particularly if you see these three-dimensional or four-dimensional videos. There are even some, you know, if you're interested, go onto YouTube and look at MRI videos of the fetus, And what you see is this extraordinary moving, rotating being that is doing double flips inside the womb and weird kind of, you know, it's absolutely extraordinary. So the fact we now can see what's going on, whereas, of course, to the ancients, this was just an invisible, dark, watery place. I think there are deliberately echoes here of the first chapter in the Bible, Genesis 1, where God creates the world, the entire cosmos, out of water and darkness. Mm. There's darkness on the face of the deep. And so,
it's hovering. You
know, here we are in Psalm 139, and lo and behold, God is creating again, but now in miniature, in microcosm. What is happening in the womb is a microcosm of the miracle of creation. Yeah. God is bringing life out of darkness and water.
My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. There's certainly ideas. You say this is a kind of the individual act of creation of each child is a recapitulation of that first act of creation. The meta creation is kind of followed by these micro recreations of every child, which in itself is a deeply profound thought and kind of religiously, theologically significant.
I mean, mind-boggling. I mean, in the ancient world, you know, the idea that some kind of thing going on in a womb, you know, had any kind of significance. I mean, this is women's work, you know, which is something for midwives and, you know, but no right-thinking man would ever imagine that there was anything particularly significant or worthwhile. So it is mind-boggling. And I just want to contrast, as we go through this psalm, I just want to, because this is what I lived with, is the contrast between the biological, scientific understanding of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way that human reproduction is taught is that you have a sperm which has found its way into the uterus and is now going up the fallopian tube, except there are millions and millions and millions of them, and they're all flapping around and competing. And then they meet an egg, and thousands of these sperm then enfold the egg. And then it's an entirely random process, you know, which particular sperm penetrates the egg. And then you get a random process of the genome, the way the genome is constituted, again, depending on, you know, random events. And scientifically, this process is, first of all, it's seen as an entirely random, meaningless, you know, which particular sperm, which particular egg. But then once it starts, it's then mechanistic. And so you then get the whole process of mitosis, which is the dividing of cells, which is a kind of mechanical process, which we understand quite a lot about. And so you get one cell click, two cells click, four cells click, eight cells click, 16 cells. The whole thing is just the mechanism is now going into action. So it's this combination of random chance, meaninglessness, and then a mechanistic.
And in the DNA era, the kind of dominant metaphor is that of programming. So we have this idea that the DNA, this new DNA has been made, right? So you've got the sperm bringing 23 chromosomes and the egg bringing 23 chromosomes. Tell me when I get this wrong because I'm bad at this. And they fuse and suddenly you have this whole genome and that lays out the code. And from that initial single-celled organism is all the code that dispels out step by step how this is going to grow into a fully-fledged human being in 9 months' time, and in fact beyond birth, continue to develop all the way up to adulthood. And it's just a computer program following the code that it's been given from moment one.
That's right. And this is the incomprehension of the embryologist. You know, the embryologist sits at the microscope and stares at this cell or collection of little bundle of cells and says, what is the big deal, guys? This is a cell. It's got a nucleus. We know about what a nucleus is. A nucleus is composed of, you know, blah, de, blah, de, blah, and all this machinery. It's got cytoplasm. That's the slush around the nucleus. It's got a bilipid membrane, which is the cell surface. We know all about these things. We know how they're constituted, and we know how mitosis works. And then you religious mumbo jumbo come along and say, oh, how wonderful this is, and isn't this amazing? You know, get with the project. It's a cell. And most embryologists, therefore, simply adopt this. And they, you know, of course, they know at the back of their mind that their darling daughter, who is the light of their life, was once like this cell that they're looking at down the microscope. But they manage to just live in this completely compartmentalized world.
And even more so in the era, as we've discussed on numerous previous podcasts, the era of, you know, embryology research, you know, up to 14 days, you can play around with this thing. You can insert new DNA and you can clone and all these other, you can't clone. You can do lots of other weird and wonderful things.
You can clone, you just mustn't put it
mustn't
back.
Let it carry on, yeah.
But you can certainly do the cloning.
Yeah, you can do all this snipping and splicing and dicing in the test tube, in the lab. And as long as you don't let them grow up into a human being, I guess if you're doing that, it is hard not to start to think of this as a kind of like a Lego kit where you can just add bits on. It's just a cell like any other cells. And as we talked about before, we're starting to learn how you can turn other skin cells into, you know, embryonic cells. And you know, what's so special? It's just a cell.
And so this is the kind of schizophrenia, which, you know, when you're trying to be understand as a Christian, you know, how to think about all this stuff, and at the same time you're being trained in embryology.
And yes, Psalm 139 has a radically different type of language or thinking about that same being, whatever you want to call it. It's not mechanistic, impersonal, random. It's deeply human, it's deeply purposeful, and it's very personal.
Exactly right. So it's like the complete opposite. You know, this rich, theologically profound poem is presenting 180 degrees away from this mechanistic, impersonal, random process. And it so what you see here is it is, first of all, it's the act of creation, as though God himself is, you know, minutely constructing, weaving together, you know, the way that I'm going to make this unique person. It is
even weaving as a metaphor is, you know, patient work. It's detailed, it's attentive. It's not, oh, I'm a powerful magician, I clip my fingers and then a blaze of light. It takes hours, you know, to weave threads together to create a piece of cloth, to knit things, you know. I don't knit, but I've seen people knit, and it's a really slow, laborious process.
Yeah, it's 9 months, mate. It's 9 months of embroidery that, you know, is involved in creating a baby. And, you know, and it takes 9 months of this patient loom work. Mm. And so this is, but also it's the language of covenant. So it's hidden in the Hebrew language, but the language of covenant is there. So you know me. You know when I sit down. This is not intellectual knowledge, like, you know, this is a surveillance camera. Oh, yeah, yeah. I know what you're doing. You know, I've got you taped. It isn't that understanding of knowing. It is the intimacy of covenantal knowing. It's the same kind of, it's the same word that is used of Adam having sexual intercourse with Eve. Adam knew Eve, his wife. Mm. It's that kind of covenantal commitment. Mm. You know me, you're involved with me, you're committed to me throughout the whole. And that covenant commitment starts from the very, very earliest moments of my life.
Mm. And what are we understanding from fearfully and wonderfully made? What are those? Slightly kind of, we're kind of familiar with that phrase. It's kind of, you know, on Christian bumper stickers. And yet, what does it mean to be made fearfully and wonderfully?
Yeah, well, there is a sense of awe, isn't there? I mean, again, this is not frightening fear. It is respect fear. It is fearing God. This is, let's not just take this for granted. the wonder of what is made. And actually, you know, the truth is, when you're doing the scientific bit, you do have those moments of awe where you say, whoa. Like, for instance, it turns out that there are nearly 100 billion neurons or brain cells, which is 10 to the 11, so 100 billion neurons. And each one of those 100 billion neurons, or nearly, have been formed in the center of the brain and have wiggled their way out as the brain develops. In the first few months of life, of unborn life, these neurons are wiggling their way physically from the center of the brain, and they form the outer layer, the cortex of the brain. But then what happens is each of those 100 billion cells makes on average about 1,000 connections with other cells. And that means you have 10 to the 14 or 100 trillion nerve connections. And all of those 100 trillion nerve connections occur basically in the last 3 months of life before delivery, the last trimester, from about 24 weeks up until term. And so I did a back of the envelope connection calculation and worked out that there were tens of millions of new connections happening literally every second in this period between 24 weeks and term. And I used to sort of teach people and make that point, because we have on the intensive care unit many, many babies undergoing care during that period between 24 weeks and term. So I said, you've got to imagine, you know, underneath that little woolly hat with the baby sleeping so peacefully, what you've got to imagine is this absolutely feverish activity of hundreds of millions of connections all whirring away and cells finding one another way. And, you know, that's going on every single second as the brain is developing. I mean, just mind-boggling. You couldn't make it up. So, yeah, even in science, there is a sense of wonder and fear. But I think that it is particularly... this psalm is expressing that sense of wonder, and in fact, the way the Hebrew is written, it actually says, "I am fearfully, wonderfully, wonderful your works," as though, you know, wonderfully wonderful. It's just as though David is just overwhelmed by the wonder, and I think that means that each one of us can actually say, "I am wonderful." You know, being me, being made, I am wonderful. And that is just such a profound and significant thing. And I think we forget that so easily. We forget it about ourselves and we forget it about someone else. I've never met someone who cannot say, I am wonderful.
Because I was going to say, is that the kind of idea of fearfulness and wonderfulness makes you think of being made in God's image, and that there is something, there's the spark of the divine within each human being, you know, because we are told, you know, awe and wonder and fear, and that kind of holy fear in the Old Testament is normally directed towards God. And these are the kind of appropriate responses when we encounter the divine. And the psalm is kind of telling us that actually inside every single one of us, even before we were born, there was something of the wonder and fearful or awesome majesty of our God in each of us. And this is a kind of, I guess it's a reiteration, another of that cornerstone of Christian theology, which is that all human beings have dignity and value and worth and preciousness. And as you say, wonder, because they're all made in God's image by him.
Yeah. And it comes from creation. And of course, this again is so hard to align with the embryologist's perspective. Mm. You know, are you really telling me that this blob of cells is uniquely wonderful? I mean, how can you say that? It's not wonderful. It's a collection of cells. And I think that's the challenge of holding together, you know, these two realities and living in the complexity of it. And it in particular, I think, you know, and again, we've talked about this before, but it's the discovery that miscarriage, spontaneous failure of implantation, is actually exceedingly common.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some estimates that up to 50% or more of embryos that are formed in the fallopian tube fail to implant in the and are lost in the monthly menstruation. And of course, the woman never knows that there was an embryo there. It's below the radar screen. It's unknowable. And yet it is the reality. And how, what do you make of that? How what theological significance? What does that say? And again, you know, people have tried to encompass that within their own understanding, and there are different positions. Some people have concluded that if it's genuinely true that a person starts at the moment of fertilization, then this means that half of all the persons that have ever been created did not make it beyond the embryonic stage, but that doesn't mean they won't be part of the new heaven and the new earth in some way.
Well, heaven is full of countless billions of people who never actually walked on the planet at any point.
But God may have brought to fruition in another in another way. But it may also be a reflection of the brokenness of creation, because it turns out that very many of those, when you analyze them, they have very abnormal chromosome features which are not compatible with life.
Mm.
And most major chromosomal abnormalities are not compatible with life. It's only the relative rarity of things like Down syndrome where you have a major chromosomal abnormality and it is compatible with life.
Mm.
I want to remind you about a very important once-a-year opportunity that's taking place on December the 2nd, Giving Tuesday. When you give on Giving Tuesday, your gift to Premier Insight will go twice as far. Thanks to a generous $5,000 matching grant, every dollar you give today will be doubled, helping us reach even more people searching for truth in a culture of confusion. Your gift equips people with biblical clarity and reaches skeptics through content like Unbelievable and Ask NT Write Anything. But we only have 24 hours on Giving Tuesday to raise $5,000 and stay on track to meet our year-end goal. So don't wait. Go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to give now and double your impact. Now back to today's episode.
Mercy Ships is transforming lives across Africa through medical training and free surgery. Joining me is Dr. Manjeet Dhillon, a volunteer surgeon. Dr. Manjeet, for anyone who doesn't know, what does Mercy Ships actually do?
Mercy Ships is a faith-based charity who deploy hospital ships to some of the poorest parts of the world, and our hospital ship will dock for several months in places where people simply can't access safe surgery. On board, we have everything you would find in a modern hospital. Patients are offered world-class surgery completely free of charge, and at the same time, we train local doctors and nurses so they can keep providing care after we're gone.
You must have met so many people whose lives have been changed. Are there any that stayed with you?
On a recent visit to Madagascar, I met 2-year-old Armella. She was born with a grapefruit-sized tumour behind her ear. Her mum prayed every day that someone would help her. And when our ship arrived, myself and other medical and nursing volunteers from around the world removed the tumour free of charge. Now Armella is healthy, happy and full of life.
And how can listeners help more people like Armella?
Right now, every gift is being matched pound for pound up to 400,000. Your generosity could help a child get the surgery they've been waiting for, or help train a nurse or doctor to change lives for years to come.
Thank you, Dr. Manjeet. If you'd like to help transform more lives like Armella's, visit mercyships.org.uk/premier.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I guess some of the pushback might come from people saying, we're spinning an enormous web of theological profundity on a handful of verses. And this psalm was never written by David or included in the Psalter to be the kind of cornerstone of neonatal ethics in Christianity. Are we not building too much on relatively a few scant verses that are fundamentally a reflection from David, a quite unique individual in the kind of salvation history story of the people of Israel? He is talking about how significant he was as an unborn child, because he was the God knew he was going to grow to be the anointed king. This doesn't mean that we can read across to all pregnancies, all clumps of cells in the earliest stages.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that criticism has been made repeatedly, and particularly when I was a medical student and starting along with this journey, that criticism was made quite often by people who say, yeah, we take the Bible seriously, but you mustn't overinterpret this one verse, this one psalm, and that all that it tells us definitively about is David himself and his own relationship with God. We may be able to, and another criticism that was sometimes made is, of course, that applies to somebody who can say, you know, I, who understands they exist. If you know that you exist, then by definition, this psalm applies to you, but you can't say that it therefore applies to an embryo or a fetus whose life came to an end, so they never knew they existed. You know, can you really apply this psalm to them?
Yeah. I guess that's an extension of that idea you mentioned earlier, which is, you were kind of hinting at, which is that one way of looking at it would be to say, rather than saying, every conception, every time a sperm fuses with an egg, a human being in God's image is made, even if it only exists for a matter of days before it is it dies or is destroyed, reabsorbed into the body because it is incompatible with life. Maybe you extend that thought and say, well, hang on, maybe you and I became humans at the point of conception because God foreknew that we would grow and develop through 9 months of pregnancy, be successfully born and grow into humans. But God does not bestow that kind of divine spark of life upon other conceived eggs, which God knows in his divine foreknowledge are not going to follow that journey for whatever reason.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a reminder that you can't build a whole sort of worldview or a theologically based ethics on a single passage. You know, we've got to, and I would definitely say that to use this psalm as sort of proof positive that this is the knockdown evidence that abortion is always wrong, it is to twist this psalm in a way, and therefore we must build it up from the whole of the biblical witness about its views of life and the ending of life and so on, and we must frame it within a coherent understanding, and that includes, you know, not just what the Bible has to say, but the way that for 2,000 years Christians have been reflecting on these scriptures. You know, we just haven't popped out from nowhere. And to be honest, I think that's sometimes a bit of a risk for evangelicals, that they tend to be deeply dismissive of 2,000 years of Christian history. They say, well, okay, we'll take the Bible and we'll take Paul and we'll take the early church. But, you know, then for the last 2,000 years, it's all been very, very dodgy, you know, until we came along. And then suddenly it's almost like the Almighty says, well, hallelujah, we've got people who read the Bible and they're taking it seriously, you know. So we don't need to think about, you know. And to be honest, I think that is crass. And how dare we say, you know, the Holy Spirit has been teaching the church for 2,000 years, leading the church into all the truth. How dare we say, oh, well, nothing to learn there. So yes, we frame our understanding of ethics from a very rich tapestry, but this is part of it.
Yeah. I mean, one other thing people might point out is that there's no real sense of timing or the age of the fetus/unborn child in this psalm. And maybe the bits that David is referring to are kind of, you know, second trimester onwards. And we can consider those to be, in ethics terms, you know, full members of the human race along with us. But there is a kind of dividing line at some point in the first few months between the two. I mean, that's certainly an approach that I know is common in some other faiths when they trying to think about kind of neonatal ethics, perinatal ethics. And certainly there are some church traditions that would say, you know, we are opposed to abortion when it is beyond a certain point, you know, maybe second or third trimester. But we don't think there is a blanket moral prohibition on abortion if it is earlier on in the pregnancy, because we're not convinced that life has begun at this point.
That's absolutely right. And I think that, again, these are arguments which go back a very long way. And in fact, there's some of the early church fathers who effectively took that view. And they tried to make a distinction, what was sometimes called the unformed fetus and the formed fetus. And so the idea was, in the first few weeks, the fetus was unformed. And it was only later on that it became formed. And that, therefore, the significance of abortion, for instance, in the unformed stage, it was never seen as something that was trivial and unimportant, but it was seen as something as a lesser significance compared to abortion at a later stage. And interestingly, in the secular world, in secular ethics, most people today would have some position like that. They would say, which is often called the gradualist understanding, you know, of life in the womb, development in the womb, and the early stages, it's very little significance. And then gradually, as you go through pregnancy, the life becomes more and more valuable, more and more significant, until by the time you get to term, clearly this is a very valuable and significant life to be protected. And it's interesting how many people just naturally adopt that kind of view. Philosophically and theologically and logically, it is virtually impossible to find any way of defending that gradualist position. You know, is human value depend on how big you are? So when you're big, you're really worth a lot. And when you're small, you're not, you're worth less. Is it possible to say that some human beings have real value and some people don't, and that it gradually increases? You know, that value is a sort of starts at naught and it's like a light dimmer, you know, it gradually increases. So, in fact, interestingly, philosophers who are not Christians are forced into, if you can't accept that it's valuable from the beginning, then we have to accept it isn't valuable all the way up until term. And as we know, there are some philosophers who are arguing that actually it goes beyond birth then, since we can't find any point at which, you know, the fetus becomes significant, why should the newborn baby be significant? Maybe it's self-awareness that is the really critical thing, which happens much later on.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, I remember reflecting on this myself when I was thinking about this as a kind of teenager and saying there has to be a point, but if you can't find a logical point, then the only way you end up is going back to conception. I mean, some people argue a lot about creating this dividing line within the pregnancy around viability. So the idea that once the child could survive by itself outside the womb, even if it was born very prematurely, that child should be a human being we should give some kind of protection to. But if the child is non-viable, if it was born at this point, it would immediately die or whatever we did, that would be the point at which abortion or would be permissible, or, you know, we don't consider them to be a full human being like you and I. And in fact, that is almost how the kind of UK law works, isn't it? On the Abortion Act, is the time limit is loosely around, and it was initially set at 28 weeks, I believe, and then it was brought down to 24 weeks. And in part, the argument was, well, babies are born before 28 weeks all the time now, and we've developed highly skilled neonatal intensive care practices which allow them to survive. And we brought the time limit down to 24. Of course, the challenge with that is viability is not an absolute standard. It's a mutating thing depending on the quality of neonatal care you have there, and also will probably reduce in the future as it has been gradually coming down. I mean, you know better than me, Dad. There are babies who have been born before 24 weeks who have survived. So viability as this kind of bright dividing line doesn't really work either.
Absolutely. And just to point out that actually in the UK, since the latest amendment, the decriminalisation amendment, that has gone. The distinction now between viability is that the implication is at whatever stage, all the way until term, the destruction of this life is morally insignificant and is not a criminal matter if it's performed by the mother.
Only by the mother.
Very much easier by the mother.
Doctor just seeks to destroy a life after 24 weeks, unless, of course, the child is significantly disabled, in which case the viability distinction is ignored as well.
Exactly. So the law is an ass, and trying to build up any kind of moral coherence is very problematic. But I think it is possible. I think it's possible for Christians to start with a prior commitment, you know, I want to say abortion is wrong from the point of conception, end of story. You know, I've decided, I've been taught that's what the Bible says. And therefore I'm going to read this psalm as though it proves it. And I personally feel that's, you know, I understand, of course, why people want to make a bright and shining line. But it's dangerous when we then read into the scriptures what we want it to say, as opposed to what it actually says. The way I would put it is, what the psalm shows, it seems to me, is however far back I can possibly go in my own existence, and therefore, and in all human existences, there is no point at which I can confidently say there isn't a person there. And therefore, I feel in that sense of ignorance, we should play safe. And that's why I think intentionally destroying even an embryo at the very early stages is morally wrong, because I can never know whether there is a person there or not. Whereas it seems to me personally that the evidence from the miscarriage, the failure to implant, suggests that in fact there are a very significant number of embryos who, for whatever reason in God's mysterious providence, never do become a person, never could become a person. But I can't know that in advance.
I mean, there's an interesting verse 16, your eyes saw my unformed body, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. I think a lot of people would read that and say, that is David going all the way back to day one, you know, before, you know, this, like, that's almost that idea of before a human is formed or unformed, that kind of Aristotelian idea that there is some kind of shift in pregnancy, which we now know is not really the case. You know, the embryo develops kind of progressively. There isn't a point where it's unformed or formed. But David seems to be grasping that idea that, you know, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. A lot of people would say, well, that seems to point to conception. The first day God saw this, God saw and knew David before a single day, before day one of his life.
Yes, it's just, of course, David knew nothing about conception. And therefore, well, at least again, that's, you know, did they interestingly, the Nicene Creed has conceived by the Virgin Mary. So they did have the concept of conception, but its significance that we now understand in terms of, you know, the creation of a genetic code and all that, I think these are deeply mysterious things. And we have to try and use the text with integrity, not to twist it to make what we want it to say, but whilst at the same time just sensing this astonishing sense of the dignity and significance of the unborn life at its very earliest stages.
And I think there's something really appropriate and fitting about falling into a position of there are mysteries here, there are unknownness, because the whole point of the psalm is that what is unknown to us as people is not unknown to God. And so we say, even with our ultrasound and our knowledge of the genome and our embryology and our microscopes, there are still things biologically and ethically and that philosophically that are unknown to us about the start of life. And that's why, as you say, we need to tread carefully. We need to be, I would probably agree with you that it's not safe to intentionally destroy embryonic life at any point. But we don't, actually, there's something quite appropriate saying that doesn't mean that we can stand like God with perfect bird's eye vision and say, that's a person, that's not a person. Life begins at this second, this millisecond. Like, none of that is known to us, but that is known to God. And there's something appropriate about us humbling ourselves and saying, we are never, even in 1,000 years more development, going to know about the mystery of life, because that alone lies in God's hands. And our responsibility is to act humbly as creatures within that framework that God is the creator, and to seek to respect his creative intent and his ability. He is the author of life, after all, not us.
Exactly right. And in fact, it reminds me of another scientific argument made against this, and that is that fertilization itself is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It takes place over hours as there's gradually merging. So are you saying at this point it isn't a person, at this point it is a person? What point are we talking at? And so I think these things are far more complex. But the other thing I just wanted to say is reflect on the psychological import of losing an unborn baby, either by abortion or miscarriage. So the natural assumption amongst many people, lay people, and to be honest, amongst many doctors as well, is that the degree of emotional loss depends on a gradual growing commitment. And therefore, if you lose an unborn baby at 6 weeks, obviously that's going to be much less significant than losing an unborn baby at 16 weeks, which is going to be much less significant than losing a baby at 26 weeks, and so on. But all the psychological evidence is that that's not true. And in fact, recently we've talked on a previous podcast about the rediscovery, if you like, of the emotional significance of miscarriage. And that even women who've lost a baby, quotes, at 6 weeks gestation can find the whole experience absolutely devastating because of their knowledge that this was a baby. The fact it was a very tiny baby, a very unformed baby, doesn't make any difference to the psychological and emotional sense of it was a baby. Mm-hmm. And this seems to me another factor in this kind of understanding the morality of abortion, that even our deepest human intuitions don't fit with this gradualist understanding that, and that's why, an abortion at 6 weeks can still have devastating emotional consequences, not always, but for some people, just as much as an abortion at 16 weeks or at 26 weeks or at 36 weeks.
Yeah. And I think one other thing it's important to say as we're coming to an end of this episode is it seems quite relevant to be talking about this as we start thinking about Christmas coming up and Jesus being born, God being born as a human. And this psalm, I think, plays into the doctrine of the incarnation as well, doesn't it? That God himself, David's talking about himself, but if we do take this as saying theologically rich things about all human beings, then we're saying that when Jesus was conceived inside Mary, God knitted himself, or God the Father knitted God the Son together in that womb.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing just to try and remind ourselves is how utterly and totally unexpected the incarnation was. There was all these prophecies, this great hope, that the Messiah was going to come, God's going to restore the kingdom, Isaiah, the temple is going to be the center, Zion, we know it's going to happen. We're praying for it. We're believing, we're trusting, we're your faithful people, God. What nobody but nobody had the possible conception, idea that God would turn himself into a baby, would turn himself into a human being and would experience humanity from the inside. I mean, that was just completely inconceivable and unexpected. And yet to us, it's a kind of commonplace now. We say, oh yeah, of course, you know, he became a, you know, it's what Christmas is all about. And so I think we just need to remind ourselves how utterly mind-boggling that is and was. And as you say, when you go back and you read Psalm 139, say, yeah, hang on a minute. So God the Father is knitting together the human form of God the Son in Mary's womb. You know, she is the Theotokos, the mother of God, you know, in the womb. She is, you know, how do you get your head around that? And that this is now applying to, and one of the phrases that I've used repeatedly, and I do believe, is that because God became a fetus, then all fetuses are special. You know, that this womb, which was always a wonderful creation chamber, has now become a temple. It is now a sacred place. The womb is the place in which God was formed. And that has mind-boggling implications. And is part of one, I have to say, it's part of the spiritual obscenity of abortion, because this sacred place has now become the killing fields, and is the place in which hundreds of thousands of lives are just destroyed in the UK every year. And Christmas, as we come into Advent and into Christmas, it is a reminder of you're born of a virgin's womb.
Begotten, not created. And I think I'm always struck by that beginning of Luke's gospel. You know, we always, at Christmas nativity services, everyone does the readings from Luke 2. But the clue is that Luke doesn't begin his gospel right there. In those days, Caesar Augustus ordered a census of the whole world. There's a whole chapter that we often just skim over, which is actually incredibly rich. And that's, you know, the chapter where John, you know, Elizabeth and Zechariah have this miracle baby. And Zechariah has this, you know, encounter in the temple. And then Mary meets Gabriel and is told she's going to bear a child. And then she goes to stay with her cousin Elizabeth. And then suddenly the unborn children, months away from being born, at this point they must be quite small inside their wombs, of John and Jesus, these cousins, enter into the narrative and become agents, become characters in the story. And they start interacting and they're leaping and it sparks, you know, the Magnificat and all this stuff is going on. And I'm like, isn't it fascinating that Luke, a doctor, not only includes this story, but makes it at the very pivotal beginning of his narrative, that unborn children are not overlooked. They're not just because they're invisible to human eyes. They can actually be fully agents in the story, in the unfolding drama of Christmas.
No, absolutely. You know, and of course, because Luke was a physician, I inevitably, you know, try and feel my way into him, you know. And so he was Paul's personal physician. He was clearly a Hippocratic physician. He'd been educated. Apparently, the scholars say Luke's gospel is far and away the best Greek in the New Testament. You know, because this is a guy who's been properly educated, like these, unlike these barbaric shepherds, and even Paul. You know, I mean, he's basically a rabbinic Jew, and he's using Greek in very unconventional ways. But whereas Luke is the real deal, you know, he's a proper educated Greek physician. But he goes along. You know, he's very close to Paul. He goes on the missionary journeys. He sees all these miracles. You know, he's absolutely part of that early church. And then he decides he's going to write a gospel, and he's going to do it properly. You know, not like these shepherds. You know, he's going to do a proper job. And that means, you know, he's going to go you can imagine him with his notebook, and he goes around and he interviews Mary. And he says, no, just tell me down, first person, what happened? I'll write it all down. And he goes and he talks to Peter and he talks to the apostles and so on. And then he's got to write a gospel. And you know what it's like as a journalist. You know, I've got vast amounts of stuff. How am I going to write my article? And I'm going to have to leave out most of it. And then he looks at this bit about these two pregnant women meeting together. And he says, I can't leave that bit out. I'm sorry. That's got to go in. It's just so amazing. And I agree with you. I think it's one of those little incidents. But actually, you can work out how old they are. So John the Baptist is about 7 months gestation. So he is a, you know, he's a big baby. He's about 28 weeks, 30 weeks. She's heavily pregnant. He's moving around and doing his thing already. And Jesus, she has just had the message from the angel. And she's, you know, takes a deep breath and says, let it be to me as you have said. I agree. I give my consent. And then she goes running to visit her cousin to give her the good news. So probably she's no more than 3 weeks or 3 or 4 weeks. So what you should imagine is that in this room, you've got Mary and Elizabeth, you've got the unborn John the Baptist, 7 months or so, and you've got Jesus, who is literally, imagine, less than 5 millimeters. 2 or 3 millimeters. And Elizabeth, filled with the Holy Spirit, says, how can it be? You know, blessed are you, Mary, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And how can it be that the mother of my Lord, and my Lord is about 3 to 5 millimeters? You just think, and yet she's filled by the Holy Spirit. That's the truth. And so I think it is just a wonderful, but of course it makes the point. My Lord is ruling the universe from his 3 millimeter body. You know, you couldn't make it up. Who would have, you know, I've got a plot. Okay. I've got a plot for a new story. Who would have thought that up? It is, I mean, at one level it's laughable. It's ridiculous, or it is the most profound and wonderful mystery you've ever come across.
Yeah. And I remember, I can't remember the name of it, but there's one of those heresies that flourished in the first few hundred years of the church about when they were arguing about Christology, and that said, you know, well, Jesus was God, but he was born a man, and then God kind of came into him, took him over. He became a kind of avatar of God. And then maybe the godliness left at some point on the cross. And the church kind of, you know, knocked heads together and decided this wasn't true and denounced that as a heresy. And I think, you know, that's why, or that's not one, that's part of why this story, and going all the way back to Psalm 139, what it draws on is relevant, is that actually there is this chain of thinking about the unborn child, that David starts thinking deep thoughts thousands of years earlier. It's picked up by Luke in the first century, and it comes to fruition in those councils a few centuries later, when they say, no, actually there was no point when Jesus was not fully divine and yet also fully human. And yes, it doesn't make sense. Yes, it's obscene. Yes, it's a scandal. Yes, it's a mystery. And yet it's still also the foundation of our faith and something we stand on to this day.
That's right. So that formulation has now stood for 1700 years or longer, yeah. You know, that Christians around the world, Orthodox Christians, have always come back to that. That's the best way we can, fully God, fully man. We don't understand it, but those are the truths and we stand by them. Okay, yeah. we should be drawing things to a close, but I hope that that's been helpful. And I think we understand these are deep waters, and it may be that you, like us, struggle to get your heads around it sometimes, and yet it is deeply relevant, and I hope it explains a bit about why this psalm has haunted me, certainly as someone working in this area of the ethics of newborn and unborn life, as a framework which has continues to inspire me and move me to tears sometimes.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, we'd love to know your own thoughts or responses to what we've been talking about. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. As you'd expect, there's an enormous trove of material on Dad's website about abortion and the unborn child and neonatal ethics. and from lots of different perspectives. So do go and have a read and look at some of that stuff. That's johnwyatt.com. And we also would really value you sending in suggestions for other things to talk about. They can both be, you know, big ideas in theology and the Bible and Christian tradition, but also kind of new developments in science, technology, culture, medicine, ethics, the church. As you know, if you listen to this podcast, we have wide-ranging interests and we like to roam far and wide. So please do send in suggestions and thoughts. And yeah, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Mercy Ships is transforming lives across Africa through medical training and free surgery. Joining me is Dr. Manjeet Dhillon, a volunteer surgeon. Dr. Manjeet, for anyone who doesn't know, what does Mercy Ships actually do?
Mercy Ships is a faith-based charity who deploy hospital ships to some of the poorest parts of the world, and our hospital ship will dock for several months in places where people simply can't access safe surgery. On board, we have everything you would find in a modern hospital. Patients are offered world-class surgery completely free of charge, and at the same time, we train local doctors and nurses so they can keep providing care after we're gone.
You must have met so many people whose lives have been changed. Are there any that stayed with you?
On a recent visit to Madagascar, I met 2-year-old Armella. She was born with a grapefruit-sized tumour behind her ear. Her mum prayed every day that someone would help her. And when our ship arrived, myself and other medical and nursing volunteers from around the world removed the tumour free of charge. Now Armella is healthy, happy and full of life.
And how can listeners help more people like Armella?
Right now, every gift is being matched pound for pound up to 400,000. Your generosity could help a child get the surgery they've been waiting for or help train a nurse or doctor to change lives for years to come.
Thank you, Dr. Manjeet. If you'd like to help transform more lives like Armella's, visit mercyships.org.uk/premier.